Ari Berman took the title of his new book, Give Us Back the Ballot, from Martin Luther King Jr.'s first major speech about voting rights back in 1957. In this next hour, Ari Berman, a journalist for The Nation, tells the history and the current state of the Voting Rights Act in the U.S. The talk was sponsored by the Center for Media and Democracy and co-sponsored by the Madison Institute, the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin, Common Cause Wisconsin, Wisconsin Book Festival, and One Wisconsin Institute. And it was held on September 27, 2016, which happens to be National Voter Registration Day. First, we hear from John Nichols, Washington editor for The Nation, who introduces Ari Berman. But first, Nichols gives a short history of voting rights in Wisconsin.
We are very, very proud in Wisconsin. Very proud of the fact that except for the current interregnum, this state has led the United States in its support for voting rights. This state is not just another state. This state is different and better. We did not fight in the Civil War merely to maintain the Union. People from this state fought in the Civil War because we wanted to end the sin of human bondage, and we believed that the people who were taken out of bondage should immediately be given voting rights. Wisconsinites led the fight in the United States Senate and in the House of Representatives for a constitutional amendment to give ex-slaves voting rights in 1865. The fact is, we have always been on the right side of these issues. In 1963, John Kennedy went to Texas in November of 1963 because on November 9th of that year, the state of Texas had voted on a referendum on ending the poll tax. Democrats in Texas had divided. Kennedy had come out strong against the poll tax. He felt he needed to go to Texas to try and unite the party and get it back together for the 64 election. Before he went to Texas, he called and wrote to John Reynolds, the governor of Wisconsin. John Reynolds was governor from 62 to 64, only 2 years. But during that period, Kennedy was trying to pass a national constitutional amendment to ban the poll tax, to ban the economic barrier to voting. And Kennedy contacted John Reynolds and said, notes to him, and said, how's it going? Are you going to get this thing passed in Wisconsin? And John Reynolds said, you will have no problem in the state of Wisconsin. You worry about other states, but this state will lead the way in opposing the poll tax. And Wisconsin voted for that constitutional amendment before the vast majority of other states. The next year, the Democratic National Convention in 1964, when Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Freedom Delegation came to that convention, Lyndon Johnson did not want to fight. But Congressman Robert Castemeyer from Madison was on the Credentials Committee. And even when the Johnson White House and Hubert Humphrey wanted to compromise on the question of seating the Mississippi Freedom Delegation, Robert Castemeyer continued to say no compromise. The President of the United States called him. The incoming nominee for Vice President called him. All of the powerful people in the party called him and said, back down, back off. And Robert Castemeyer said no, because you don't compromise on civil rights and voting rights. And when members of the Mississippi Freedom Delegation and of the Alabama delegation came to the floor of the Democratic National Convention in 1964, they were allowed on the floor, but there were no seats for them. It happened that the Wisconsin delegation was in front of the Southern delegations. And the chairman of the Wisconsin delegation that year looked at the situation, realized that there were African Americans standing on the floor of a Democratic National Convention looking for a place to sit. And that chairman, Fred Risser, told the Wisconsinites to get up and to give their seats to the people from the South, to African Americans from the South, because Wisconsin would never stand in the way of civil rights and voting rights. That is who we are. Never, ever forget that. Our current administration has sinned against the basic premises of this state. It is our job to fight them every step of the way, not simply on behalf of voting rights, but on behalf of a Wisconsin tradition that is different and better than our current governor will ever be, and different and better than any state in this nation. We are a state of civil rights and voting rights and a willingness to struggle for them. And I am so honored that my friend and comrade, Ari Berman, who has written a book hailed by John Lewis and by all of the greats of the civil rights movement, of the voting rights movement, has come to be with us in Wisconsin as we rededicate ourselves to the struggles that have always been at the heart and soul of this state. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ari Berman.
It is really so great to be here. I want to thank John for introducing me. I've always wondered how the Washington editor of The Nation could live in Madison, Wisconsin. Sometimes I wonder if John helped plant people like Scott Walker, just so he could have more material. Because this has really been the center of the action, John. You don't even have to go to Washington. You can just be here. And every time you talk, there's a new history lesson, things I didn't know. I didn't know any of that stuff you just told me, so it was really remarkable history. I'm really honored to be here. I'm wearing red, even though I'm an Iowa Hawkeye fan. It's painful for me to do this, but better Wisconsin than Michigan. That's what I think. So it's great to be here as an Iowan who now lives in New York. So this is a really fitting time to have this conversation because today was National Voter Registration Day. So there's lots of parallels between some of the fights that happened back then and the fights that are happening now. My book is called Give Us the Ballot because that was the first major speech that Martin Luther King gave about voting rights in 1957. He was just 28 years old. This was 2 years after he led the Montgomery bus boycott with Rosa Parks. And he gave this speech at the Lincoln Memorial. It was called the Prayer Pilgrimage for Freedom. It was in many ways the precursor to the March on Washington 6 years later. And King gave this speech, Give Us the Ballot, because they were commemorating the third anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which was supposed to desegregate public schools. But 3 years after Brown, no schools had desegregated. Not one school in the South had been desegregated. And King was asking the question why. And the reason why no schools had desegregated was because Southern white segregationists, like George Wallace in Alabama, remained in power. And so King gave this speech called Give Us the Ballot because he knew that the ballot was going to be the one thing that would allow people to change their circumstances so they could go to school where they wanted and eat where they wanted and marry who they wanted. But even more than that, so they could actually have a say in their communities. And so this really always struck me. And it was in many ways this speech in 1957 that kicked off an 8-year effort that culminated in the passage of the Voting Rights Act, which was called the crown jewel of the civil rights movement. Now, the Voting Rights Act was something that myself, I think like a lot of people, kind of took for granted. I wasn't born in 1965, as you could probably tell from looking at me. My parents didn't meet marching in Selma. I wasn't born in the segregated South. I knew about the civil rights movement, I studied it, but I think like a lot of people, I felt like we had moved on as a country. We had solved a lot of these issues. And my come to Jesus moment, even though I'm Jewish, was as John said, after the 2010 election, when people like Scott Walker were elected, and we began to see a wave of new efforts to restrict access to the ballot. 180 new voting restrictions introduced in 41 states from 2011 to 2012. Half the states in the country changed their election laws. And it wasn't just happening in the South. It wasn't just happening in Alabama and Mississippi. It was happening in places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Iowa that had a very different history, as John talked about, when it came to civil rights. So this was really alarming to me, and it wasn't getting any coverage. So I covered it first for Rolling Stone and then for The Nation magazine, and this kind of evolved into a full-time beat for me. I covered it all the way through the 2012 election, when you may remember there were 7-hour lines in the state of Florida because that state cut back early voting and eliminated voting on the Sunday before the election when black churches used to hold Souls to the Polls voter mobilization drives. When President Obama spoke on election night in 2012 and said, we have to fix that, talking about the country's election laws, there were still people in line in Florida to vote. The last person in Florida cast their ballot at 2:03 a.m. Wasn't even election night. It was at that point the next morning because of these problems in 2012. So President Obama said, we have to fix that, talking about our country's election laws. But we didn't fix the problem. The problem got worse when in June of 2013, the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act and ruled that those states with the longest histories of voting discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. It was at that point that I decided that I wanted to write my book, Give Us the Ballot, because I was asking my friends who were voting rights lawyers and experts and academics, what should I read to get up to speed on the Voting Rights Act? What did it do? Why is it being challenged? Why are we having this fight all over again today? And I was really surprised that no one had written a comprehensive history of the Voting Rights Act. There had been so much written about the events that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act, things like the marches in Selma and the protests in Mississippi. But there had been so much less written about what happened after 1965. And I thought it was critically important to tell this story because last year was the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, and I was lucky enough that day to be at the White House when it was commemorated. But I also knew that we were in a whole new struggle over voting rights, that in places like Wisconsin, this wasn't a theoretical issue. It wasn't just dry history in a textbook. It was something that people were living all over again today. So I want to talk a little bit about that history and where we're at now. Why was the Voting Rights Act necessary? Well, National Voter Registration Day is a great time to talk about this. Before the Voting Rights Act passed, only 2% of African Americans were registered to vote in Selma, Alabama. If you were a black person, you wanted to get on the voting rolls, you had to name all 67 county judges to register to vote. Something that I'm reasonably certain the 67 county judges themselves, no offense to the judges here, would not have been able to do if they had ever been asked that question. I tweeted today, Louisiana's literacy test from 1964. You guys should look at this document. Someone with a PhD in quantum physics couldn't pass it. It was designed for the sole purpose of preventing African Americans from registering to vote. There were people like James Cheney and Andrew Goodman and Mickey Schwerner who went down to Mississippi and they never came back. And that's why the Voting Rights Act was so important. Because it struck down the literacy tests and the poll taxes and all those other devices that had prevented so many people for so many years from registering to vote. But I think even more importantly, it affirmed the commitment of the nation that this was wrong. That when Lyndon Johnson came before a joint session of Congress and said, we shall overcome and introduce the Voting Rights Act, he wasn't making a case for the Democratic Party. He wasn't just making a case for the civil rights movement. He was making a case that America could not be America if we allowed this kind of thing to happen. So I think today is a perfect time to talk about the importance of registering to vote and the importance of voting on National Voter Registration Day. The Voting Rights Act didn't just get rid of literacy tests and poll taxes. Within days of the law passing, federal officials went to the South to register black voters. In the most dangerous parts of the South where no one had registered for decades, for centuries almost, you had hundreds registered within days, thousands within weeks. And I really think that this was an example of the federal government using its power for the utmost good. And when I hear people demonize government, I just think of the federal officials who went to the South after the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the work they did. Then what the Voting Rights Act did is it said that those states with the longest histories of discrimination had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. This was so important because of the history of this country after the Civil War. We passed 3 amendments to the Constitution to try to make the promise of American equality real. The 15th Amendment said very clearly the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. For a brief period of Reconstruction, that actually meant something. There were black governors and senators from states like Louisiana and Mississippi. There were 22 black members of Congress from the South. There was integrated government for the first time. Progressive whites voted for black candidates. Black candidates voted for white candidates. Then federal troops left the South after the disputed election of 1876. And we began to see things like poll taxes and literacy tests and all-white primaries and grandfather clauses, backed up by widespread violence and fraud.
You're listening to Ari Berman, a journalist for The Nation and author of Give Us Back the Ballot. He's speaking on the history and the current state of the Voting Rights Act in the U.S.
So what the Voting Rights Act said is we could not allow a situation in this country where people were enfranchised, disenfranchised, re-enfranchised, and then disenfranchised all over again. That was not who we were going to be as a country. And that's why the Voting Rights Act was so successful. It integrated every level of government for the first time. It allowed people like John Lewis to become known as the conscience of the Congress. It allowed President Obama not just to be elected in 2008, but to win 3 southern states where he more than likely would not have been able to vote in 1965, and his parents would not have been able to get married in. That's how important the law was. So a lot of my book is dedicated to talking about what I call the revolution of 1965, so people can understand just how important this law and other laws that have expanded voting rights have been. But that's not the end of the story. The fact is that the revolution of 1965 spawned an equally committed counter-revolution, that there has been a 50-year effort to roll back the Voting Rights Act and roll back the civil rights laws and the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And that began right after the Voting Rights Act was passed. Within days of the law passing, people like George Wallace said the law was unconstitutional, that the federal government didn't have the power to tell states how to set their voting qualifications. This very quickly went to the Supreme Court in the 8-1 decision in 1966. The Supreme Court said the Voting Rights Act was constitutional, that it was simply meant to enforce the 15th Amendment of 1870, which had been ignored for nearly 95 years. So that should have settled the debate. The law's upheld as constitutional. Let's move on and accept this. But then there was a new argument when people like John Lewis and Andrew Young and Barbara Jordan were elected. You began to hear that the Voting Rights Act was going to lead to quotas and proportional representation and all of these things that were fundamentally anti-American, that it was going to advantage some people over other people, that it violated quote-unquote colorblindness. This argument was made very aggressively by a young lawyer in the 1980s by the name of John Roberts, future Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And he is a pivotal figure in this counter-revolution. Roberts was a very smart guy. He was known as a Harvard, because he went to Harvard undergrad and Harvard law, something that I wish we all probably wish we could have done. So he was a very smart guy, but his career trajectory is so interesting. First, Roberts in the 1980s goes and clerks for Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist, who was appointed by Nixon and then Chief Justice by Reagan. And Rehnquist is kind of on the vanguard of this emerging conservative legal counter-revolution. Rehnquist is someone who believed that Brown versus Board of Education was unconstitutional. He believed that all white primaries in Texas were constitutional. And Rehnquist had personally administered literacy tests to black and Hispanic voters when he was a Republican Party official in Arizona in the 1960s. So first Roberts clerks for Rehnquist. And then Rehnquist becomes Roberts' entree to the Reagan Justice Department. And Reagan, despite all of the acclaim for him, was someone who opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Act of 1968, the 3 most important pieces of civil rights legislation. Reagan believed that the Voting Rights Act was, quote, humiliating to the South. And when he was elected, the Washington director of the NAACP said, Reagan doesn't just want to put civil rights on the back burner, he wants to take it off the stove completely. So this is a very different way of thinking about civil rights. And John Roberts, one of his chief responsibilities was voting rights. He wrote, there was a big fight in the Congress over whether to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. And Roberts wrote memo after memo after memo, arguing, in his words, that violations of the Voting Rights Act should not be made too easy to prove. That either the Voting Rights Act shouldn't be reauthorized, or if it was reauthorized, it should be as weak as possible. And interestingly enough, Roberts lost that fight. You had Republicans like Jim Sensenbrenner, who was just a young congressman from Wisconsin at that point, and Democrats like Ted Kennedy, who came together to overwhelmingly reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. So you begin to see the emergence of a conservative legal revolution. You realize that John Roberts didn't just wake up one day and decide to gut the Voting Rights Act. This is something he had been trying to do for over 30 years. But still, opponents of voting rights had been relatively marginalized. I think the real tipping point was the 2000 election in Florida, the first election that I ever voted in. And I know a lot of people remember things like hanging chads and butterfly ballots and Catherine Harris and some elderly Jewish voters mistakenly voting for Pat Buchanan in Palm Beach. But there was another part of that election that was really pivotal, which was that before the 2000 election, Florida did a massive voter purge. And Florida was one of only a few states that prevented ex-felons from voting. This ban dated back to Jim Crow, when African Americans could be labeled as felons simply for looking at a white woman. Many of these felon disenfranchisement laws had been repealed, but Florida's had not. And the state claimed that all of these felons were on the voting rolls and needed to be purged. The problem was twofold. First off, the purge was inaccurate. People were labeled as felons even if their last names, their middle names, their race, their sex data didn't match the voter registration rolls. The second problem was the purge was discriminatory, that African Americans in particular in Florida were 11% of the electorate, but 44% of those on the voter purge list. So what happened on election day is longtime voters showed up at the polls, they were wrongly told they were felons, and they were prevented from voting. I tell a story in my book of a man by Willie Steen, who was confused with a fellow named Osteen. Completely different name. Willie Steen's name was S-T-E-N. Osteen, the felon's name, was O apostrophe S-T-E-N. That was the first problem. The second problem was the felony that he was accused of was committed when he was serving with the U.S. military in the Persian Gulf during the first Gulf War. The third problem is he worked at a hospital in Tampa where he couldn't have a job with a felony conviction. Yet this guy took his 12-year-old son to the polls, was wrongly told he was a felon, and was prevented from voting. After the 2000 election, the NAACP sued Florida, and the state admitted that 12,000 registered voters were wrongly labeled as felons and were prevented from voting. That was 22 times George W. Bush's margin of victory in the state. And I think some people learned the very unfortunate lesson from the 2000 election in Florida, that small or not so small manipulations in the electoral process could make a very big difference in close elections. And that talking about voter fraud, whether or not the fraud actually existed, was the way to build support for these new voting restrictions. So fast forward to 2008, what happens? It's not just that President Obama is elected, it's that 5 million new voters turn out in 2008. Of those 5 million new voters, 2 million are African American, 2 million are Hispanic, and 600,000 are Asian American. And they vote 75% for President Obama. They're known as the Coalition of the Ascendant. So if you're the opposition party, and the fastest growing demographics in the country have just voted overwhelmingly against you, what do you do? The way I see it, you only have two options. You can either try to change your policies. Radical thought, I know, but you either try to change your policies to reach out to people that might not agree with you. You could support things like immigration reform and a higher minimum wage and reforming the criminal justice system. Or if you're unable or unwilling to do that, you choose another strategy. the strategy that's been used throughout American history. You try to make it harder for the people that disagree with you to be able to cast a ballot in the first place. And that's exactly what Scott Walker and Wisconsin Republicans did. We know their agenda. It's been exposed in multiple trials, in email chains, in private conversations that have become made public. We know that Senate Republicans in Wisconsin were, quote, giddy about trying to disenfranchise with the voter ID law, quote, college students and neighborhoods around Milwaukee. You can only imagine which neighborhoods they were talking about. We know that Republican congressmen here have said that voter ID was going to allow them to carry the state in 2016. We know that even before they lost an election, they were sending emails talking about pushing a bogus narrative of voter fraud to try to get an advantage in the election. So all of this has been very well exposed in Wisconsin. But I want to talk about where we are now and what has happened since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, because this is the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. And 14 states, including Wisconsin, have new voting restrictions in place for the first time. So the first thing that happened was that laws that were blocked as discriminatory, like Texas's voter ID law, where you can vote with a gun permit but not a student ID, were allowed to go into effect. The second thing that happened is states passed more sweeping voting restrictions. North Carolina, for example, didn't just require voter ID. They cut back on early voting. They eliminated same-day voter registration. They eliminated out-of-precinct voting. They even eliminated pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, which was taught in high school civics classes to encourage people to vote when they turned 18. All of this in one bill just a month after John Roberts said that racial discrimination in voting was largely a thing of the past. And the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals wrote an absolutely remarkable decision recently striking down this law. And I would urge those of you who are interested to look it up. The Fourth Circuit unanimously said that this law targeted black voters with almost surgical precision. That some of the things that North Carolina Republicans did, which is the same thing that Wisconsin Republicans did, like eliminating voting on the Sunday before the election, was as close to a smoking gun as you'll ever see in modern times. In Wisconsin, they said that early voting was cut to target black voters in places like Milwaukee. And it's interesting, in North Carolina, the court asked the state, why did you cut early voting on Sundays? And the state said, well, it was used in some counties more than others. They said, which counties was it used in more? The state said, counties that tended to be Democratic and have larger African American turnout. And the court said, you just admitted that you did this to discriminate against people based on their party and their race. So we know what's going on here. We saw these problems in the primaries. I was in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, for the primary here. And when Scott Walker said the voter ID law was working just fine, I can tell you it wasn't, unless you believe working just fine was working to keep certain people from the polls. And I want to tell a quick story, because I think it's really important to put a face to some of this stuff, so it's not just an abstraction. I wrote about a guy who I heard about through the ACLU. His name was Eddie Lee Holloway Jr. He's a 58-year-old African-American man who moved from Illinois to Wisconsin. He brought three forms of ID to the DMV to get a voter ID for voting. His photo ID from Illinois, his Social Security card, and his birth certificate. They wouldn't give him an ID because his birth certificate was spelled Eddie Jr. Holloway instead of Eddie Lee Holloway Jr. Same first name, same last name, different middle name because of a clerical error when he was born. They said he had to go to the vital records office downtown in Milwaukee to amend his birth certificate. He went down to the vital records office downtown in Milwaukee. He said, how much will it cost to amend my birth certificate? They told him between $400 and $600. They said he had to go to the Illinois State Capitol to amend his birth certificate. So he bought a bus ticket round trip to Illinois. He went to Springfield, to the Vital Records office there. They said they needed copies of his high school records and his vaccination records. So then he went to Decatur, where he was from Springfield, to get his high school records. He went back to Springfield. They said he needed to get his full Social Security statement, which he didn't have with him. So he left Illinois, went back to Wisconsin, and he called the Vital Records office, and he said, I have two copies of my full Social Security statement. Can I email or fax it over? They said, no, you have to come back in person and do it. This guy brought three forms of ID to the DMV, made seven trips to different public agencies in two different states, paid over $200, and still couldn't vote in Wisconsin. This isn't happening in 1865. This isn't happening in 1965. This is happening in 2016, right here, just an hour and a half away. It's happening in Madison, too. And I think it's really unfortunate when this happens, as John said, especially in a state like Wisconsin, which since the 1970s has had the highest turnout in the country, right neck and neck with Minnesota. It's been the state that other states look at for what to do when it comes to expanding voting rights. And Wisconsin, instead of becoming the model for what to do right with voting rights, has become the model for what not to do. It's right there with North Carolina and Texas when it comes to the states that are most aggressively suppressing the vote. And I think this is so unfortunate because there are so many things that we could be doing to get more people involved in the political process.
You're listening to Ari Berman, a journalist for The Nation and author of Give Us Back the Ballot. He's speaking on the history and the current state of the Voting Rights Act in the U.S.
On National Voter Registration Day right now, a quarter of Americans aren't even registered to vote. 50 million Americans aren't even registered to vote. They're not even part of the conversation. They're not being polled. They're not being courted. They're not even part of the presidential election. And we know that there's lots of different ways we could get them more involved. We know that states like Wisconsin that have Election Day registration have voter turnouts of up to 10% higher than states that don't. We know that in Oregon, where now you are now automatically registered to vote when you go to the DMV and get a driver's license, that 300,000 people are going to be added to the voting rolls in Oregon, and they're not going to have to do anything other than show up and do what they probably would have done anyway. So there's lots of things we could be doing to get more people involved in the political process. Some of those things have been tried right here in Wisconsin. They're incredibly popular. When Scott Walker tried to get rid of Election Day registration, it turned out his own son had used it in the last election, and he was forced to back down. So I think that not only are there lots of policies that we could pass, things like early voting and Election Day registration and making Election Day a national holiday and restoring the Voting Rights Act and ending felon disenfranchisement laws and giving people a fundamental right to vote in the Constitution so that all types of voter suppression are outlawed in the future. There's all of these things we could be doing. The problem isn't good ideas. The problem is we're lacking the political will to implement them. And so I just want to leave you with a few things that I think are really important, not just policies, but ideas on how to reframe the debate over voting rights. The first thing that I believe is that the vote is a right, not a privilege. That we talk about the vote as a right, but we've historically treated it far more as a privilege. The second thing I believe is that democracy works better when more people participate. Why do you think Scott Walker doesn't want some people to vote? Do you think it's just because he likes it? No. He wants to do certain things. He wants to roll back environmental protections and campaign finance laws and so many of the things that made Wisconsin this progressive state. And he knows that if more people turn out, if more people participate in democracy, it will be harder for him to do all of those things. And the last thing I believe is that regardless of what political party you are, trying to win an election by preventing people from voting is fundamentally immoral. That if that is your strategy for trying to win an election, you should get another job. And there was a remarkable op-ed recently by Congressman Sensenbrenner in the New York Times. And he's a very conservative guy, probably disagree with him on most issues, but he's one of the few Republicans that has sponsored legislation to restore the Voting Rights Act. And Sensenbrenner said in this op-ed, "I would rather lose my job than suppress votes to keep it." And that's something that you just don't hear from nearly any Republican right now today. So I think there's a lot we can do to fight back against this. And I think Wisconsin's gonna be so important because, as I said, this is not just a swing state, but this is a state that has really been the leader when it comes to expanding voting rights. So I'm hoping that in the year 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, I can come back to Wisconsin and talk about all the good things you are doing instead of all the voter suppression that's underway. When I was in Milwaukee during the primary, I was mostly on college campuses. I was at Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and I was at Marquette. And almost all the students were registering to vote that day. They had to get separate IDs for voting because their student IDs weren't accepted because of the way the Wisconsin legislature wrote the law, which was no accident. But not only that, they all were there to register on election day. Now, maybe some of them would have registered before, but the fact that Wisconsin had election day registration was so important. So I think registration is really critical. When you look at the demographics in places like Georgia and Texas and Arizona, these states are on the cusp of becoming competitive. But the reason that they're not competitive yet is because there are millions of unregistered voters who are disproportionately young people, lower income people, and people of color that if they voted would be more likely to vote for progressive candidates, but they're not even registered to vote. So I think registration is extremely important. Then I think the next step is obviously getting them to turn out, and that's what's the beauty of Election Day registration is you kill two birds with one stone. And that's why it's worked so effectively here. So I would like to see a lot more states emulate that. I think what Oregon's doing with automatic registration is really cool because they're gonna add 300,000 new people to the voting rolls, but then Oregon votes all by mail. So all of those new people are gonna get ballots too. So that's gonna make it more likely that once they're registered, they'll also turn out. And Colorado's kind of doing a fusion model where they're doing all by mail, but they also have election day registration in person. So if you're not registered or you don't want to vote by mail, you can still do it in person too, which is a hybrid of kind of Wisconsin and Oregon. I think that's been working well there. So I wrote two stories about Eddie Lee Holloway Jr. One, I think, was called something like "A Black Man in Wisconsin Brought Three Forms of ID to the Polls and Still Couldn't Vote." Rather provocative headline. I didn't write it, but got a lot of traffic. And then... our own BuzzFeed. And then the second thing, I wrote a long article contrasting Wisconsin and Minnesota and the divergent trajectories they've taken in recent years called "The GOP War on Voting is Working," that got more into both of these stories. So the interstate commerce thing, basically all of these states now have an effort to share data but also to purge people from the voter rolls. And there's lots of concern that it's being done in a way that's inaccurate, and also disproportionately purging people of color that may share the same name. And so they're claiming people are voting in different states even though they just share the same name. And the Kansas Secretary of State, Chris Kobach, has caused a lot of controversy. He's actually about to be held in contempt of court in Kansas. He's claiming that all of these non-citizens are on the voting rolls. And one of the people he's saying is on the voting rolls is a 90-year-old World War II vet there who's been a U.S. citizen for 50-something years and has been voted. Kobach, a while ago, said, well, all of these dead people are voting in Kansas. And he told a story about this guy named Alfred K. Brewer. He held a press conference. He said, this man, Alfred K. Brewer, he died in such and such a year, and he voted. Okay, well, first off, how did that happen? So the Wichita Eagle decided to investigate, and they found Alfred K. Brewer raking leaves in his front lawn. And he said, I don't think I'm dead, not when I'm raking leaves right here. And so I think that a lot of times there are these headlines about voter fraud. You hear it in Wisconsin all the time. People are being bussed from Chicago to Milwaukee to vote on election day. Or in Minnesota, you hear all of these Somali immigrants are voting for Keith Ellison in Minneapolis, or whatever these things might be. But when you drill down on the data, they're not It's not true. It's like these chain emails that were forwarded about Barack Obama's birth certificate. We won't say who first sent them around. It's like they take on a life of their own. I think there's been so much overheated rhetoric about voter fraud that people start to believe it, even though voter fraud is exceedingly rare. And this is one thing I didn't mention in my talk that I want to mention. Voter impersonation in particular, the type of voter ID law, the type of fraud the voter ID law would stop, is exceedingly rare. That according to one national survey, since the 2000 election, there have been 1 billion votes cast and only 31 credible cases of voter impersonation. That you're more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to impersonate another voter at the polls. And when Wisconsin went to court in defense of their voter ID law, they didn't present a single case of voter impersonation that the voter ID law would have stopped. So you think if there was any time to present your best evidence, it would have been when you're in court.
You're listening to Ari Berman, a journalist for The Nation and author of Give Us Back the Ballot. He's speaking on the history and the current state of the Voting Rights Act in the U.S.
Listen, 90% of the public has sufficient voter ID. So it's always going to be hard to message against something that 90% of the public has, because the 90% can't conceptualize the 10% that don't have it. And so it's going to be an uphill battle to begin with. And I think that, you know, it's important to remember that whereas most people have this, some people don't. And for the people that don't have it, it can be extremely burdensome for them to try to give it. They can go through what Eddie Lee Holloway Jr. went through. And we have to ask ourselves, why are we doing this? Is there any reason that we're making it harder for certain people to be able to vote? Are there different ways that we can confirm who people are without disenfranchising long-time voters? And so I don't have a problem with voter ID. I have a problem with requiring ID that not everyone has and not everyone could obtain. And if we ran elections like they run elections in Europe, where everyone is both automatically registered to vote and everyone is sent an ID card, well, there's not a problem because everyone has it. But not everyone has it in Wisconsin. And we're seeing a very clear partisan and racial impact in the people that don't have it. And in one of the many court cases in Wisconsin about this, Judge Lynn Edelman said, as you know, Jay, many more people were going to be disenfranchised by the law than cases of voter fraud that have been stopped. So this has been a completely manufactured controversy. There was one case in Wisconsin of somebody who voted 15 times. I will say that. There was one guy, Kevin, you know who he is. He voted 15 times. He was incredibly resourceful. He voted absentee with his daughter and his son and all of this stuff. But you know what? This was before Wisconsin had a voter ID law, and he was caught. So when the small amount of fraud that does happen occurs, it usually takes a lot of creativity to pull off. It usually doesn't sway that many votes, and it's usually caught in the first place without things like voter ID in effect. So I just think that this has been a very small problem. The last thing I'll say about this is I think it's important to not just focus on voter ID, because whereas voter ID laws remain popular broadly with the public, things like early voting, election day registration, these are incredibly popular too. And so it's important to remember that in Wisconsin, the voter ID law got all the coverage, but the fact that they cut early voting, that they made it harder to register to vote, that got almost no coverage. And that's a way to try to put them on the defensive. Like when they tried to eliminate election day registration, you could say to Scott Walker, well, why did your own son just use this in the last election? So I think that's one way to start to drive a wedge and then obviously connect it to broader issues. You know, Donald Trump is running around talking about all the great things he's going to do for the African-American community. How can you court black voters when your party is trying to suppress them in states like Wisconsin and North Carolina? Okay, last thing you said, the affidavit. Okay, last things. Sorry, it's kind of a long-winded answer. I think the affidavit can work as a fallback if poll workers know about it and are trained in it. But I'm worried that in states like Texas, where they have this now, that if you don't have strict forms of ID, you can sign an affidavit, that there's going to be a lot of confusion, that it can become also a fear and intimidation tactic. In Texas, the lieutenant governor and other people are saying anyone who fills out this form incorrectly is going to be prosecuted. Well, when I was just in Texas, Latino voters are terrified they're going to be put in jail for voting. So now it's what was supposed to be a remedy is now an intimidation tactic. When I went to the Board of Elections in San Antonio, they had a huge poster up on the wall that said, photo ID is required. It's not required anymore. The law has been relaxed. So I said, well, why do you still have a poster that says photo ID is required? And they said, well, we've been really busy. We haven't gotten around to updating it. We have the correct election materials behind the desk. And I said, why don't you just take the poster down until you print a new one so people aren't confused? And these weren't bad people. They weren't trying to suppress the vote. But again, they either don't know what the law is or they haven't gotten around to it or whatever it might be. Then all of a sudden someone shows up on election day, they don't have a gun permit. They only have a student ID in Texas. Are they going to be offered an affidavit? Do they know to ask for one? This is this kind of stuff that I'm concerned about. All of these issues are related. I mean, I think that the amount of money that's coming into the political system, the Citizens United decision, the effort to make it harder to vote, the effort to gerrymander political districts, they're all connected. It's all an attempt of people trying to choose their electorate other than the other way around. And so I would like to see redistricting, regardless of who it benefits, taken out of a partisan process. Now, Iowa has done this very effectively. It helps that Iowa only has 4 or 5 congressional districts, so they kind of can just split the state up. But they have a very well-respected independent commission. And even people who want to try to game the system know not to try. But it doesn't really make sense that you would try to hire yourself for a job interview, unless you were Dick Cheney. And so I think that this is something that people are becoming increasingly aware of. Like, redistricting was always this like kind of thing that like was really wonky and no one really cared about it. But like now I see a lot more people talking about it, a lot more people breaking through. But I mean, Jay was telling me, I mean, Wisconsin's a swing state, very competitive Senate race, very competitive presidential race. There are only 10 competitive, even remotely competitive, state assembly districts. Of 99. So that doesn't make sense. If Wisconsin's a swing state, shouldn't half the districts be competitive? So I think that's another way that power gets warped. I think the Supreme Court's the most important issue in the 2016 election because it was the Supreme Court that gutted the Voting Rights Act, that gave us Citizens United, that gave us Hobby Lobby, that gave us Heller, all 5-4 decisions. And there has been a conservative majority on the Supreme Court my entire lifetime. Rehnquist, Berger, Rehnquist, Roberts. That's what I lived. There are so many people that have no idea who Earl Warren was, let alone that the Supreme Court used to protect things like voting rights. And so I know there's lots of talk about personality and people get so fixated on these people and who they are, but you're not just voting for a president for the next 4 years. In this election, you're voting for control of the Supreme Court potentially for the next 20 to 30 years. So this is really, 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 really important. The fact that there's a vacant Supreme Court seat right now, and I'm shocked it's not getting more attention. I know there was a lot to cover in the first presidential debate, but what is more important than the fact that there is a vacant Supreme Court seat right now that on day one, the next president is going to decide how to fill? So I think that needs to get a lot more attention. I think it needs to be connected to lots of issues that people care about, particularly lots of younger voters who care about things like climate change and immigration and don't really see the candidates addressing it, but have to realize all of these things are coming before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court's not just an abstraction. It's something that's going to affect lots of things you care about as well. So this gives me a good chance to talk about something that the Center for Media and Democracy has worked on for a long time and really broke the story of, which is the involvement of the American Legislative Exchange Council, known as ALEC, because they were the ones who drafted mock voter ID legislation. And we began to see a virtually identical pieces of legislation introduced in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Texas. And maybe these state legislators just got really passionate about the issue and really organized. But I think this was something that was done from the highest levels and filtered on down. I don't think there was a grassroots uprising for voter ID. I think that this was something that Republicans realized that could be for their benefit. And now that they had these majorities, they had to act quickly. And so all of this stuff was among the first bills that passed. And It was in April and May of 2011 that this stuff happened, and people didn't even know what these bills were at the time when they were passing. And I blame the media a lot for not covering this issue aggressively. I mean, when my first story for Rolling Stone came out in August of 2011, it was the first national magazine story about this. And already more than a dozen states had changed their laws. And there was so much false equivalency going around that, well, some say there's voter fraud and other people say that people will be disenfranchised. Well, like drill down on what's actually happening here, that there's been so little evidence of voter fraud and there's lots of evidence of people who are being burdened. And so I think the media has been getting better. There's been more coverage of it of late. I think there's been good coverage on some MSNBC shows, and there's been good coverage in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I've noticed that there are now full-time reporters who are covering these cases. I still think they're often covering them through the lens of partisan politics. I think they're covering through the lens of, number one, will this affect elections, and number two, is it one party doing it to hurt another party, or is one party doing it to try to help themselves, as opposed to covering it from the lens of, why are we taking a fundamental right and restricting it? And so I think I would like to see more coverage of it as something that's just being done to subvert democracy, as opposed to something that may help Scott Walker in Wisconsin. Yeah, I think it's being done to help Scott Walker in Wisconsin, but I think it's wrong regardless of why it's happening. I think it's really, really unfortunate that young voters of all people have been targeted by these laws, because this is, in many cases, their first election, and they're not familiar with the process. And if they don't know how to register, they don't know what documents they need, or their eligibility is challenged, they're going to be much more vulnerable than people that have voted for a long time. And if someone's turned away in their first election, I'm extremely concerned they'll just decide not to vote for the rest of their lives, that they'll be so disgusted with the process that they'll just decide to hell with it. So I think it's critically important that when people are first getting involved in the political process, that they have these full protections. And even when there's high turnout, as you know, only half of young voters participate. So we should be asking a completely different question in Wisconsin, which is not, why are we not accepting student IDs? It should be, how do we get more young people to participate in the first place, try to get voter turnout from 50% to 80%, like it is for the rest of Wisconsinites in presidential elections? And the fact that they don't have these protections is really disturbing. I also think we have to do a better job of connecting the vote to issues they care about. Because when people talk about young people as being apathetic, I think it's completely wrong. Look at the Black Lives Matter movement. Look at the Dreamer movement. Look at the climate movement. Look at the Bernie Sanders campaign. These were driven by young voters, by young people. But I think there's a lot of cynicism in the political process. I think there are places like in Baltimore that are controlled by Black Democrats, and people say, well, we elected all these people, what does it matter? Freddie Gray still was killed in the back of a police wagon. And so I think that you have to connect these issues that they care about and show that voting is not the ultimate solution, it's one step towards the solution. And that not voting is only going to give them less power. That not voting is not a form of protest. It's just giving someone else more power than you have. It's making someone else's vote matter more than yours. Someone else's say matter more than yours. And so I don't think we can be preachy about it. I think you can't just like try to bang people over their head. But I think we can talk about the fact that, you know, if you elect different kinds of people, there could be solutions to things like criminal justice. That if you elect different justices on the Supreme Court, you have a completely different ruling for 5 million Dreamers. That, not to get too partisan here, Donald Trump just put an oil industry lobbyist in charge of his climate change and energy policy. According to one poll, 28% of young voters said there was no difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on climate change. So, I mean, some of this stuff needs to be communicated better. But I think that voting has to be seen as part of the solution, not as a roadblock to the solution. And I noticed that just on Twitter, where there's lots of young people who are very active, when I post stuff that's about the civil rights movement, like I posted Louisiana's literacy test today, lots of young people are fascinated by this history. They're looking at people from the civil rights movement and seeing parallels between what they went through in the 1960s and what's happening today. The reason why there was a march from Selma to Montgomery in the first place was because in the county adjoining Selma, Alabama, Perry County, there was a nonviolent march at night, and Alabama state troopers killed an unarmed black man named Jimmie Lee Jackson, who had tried to vote 5 times unsuccessfully. So there's lots of parallels between what's happening in the 1960s and what's happening today. And the vote can be one solution towards trying to solve these problems.
Okay, I'd like to thank you
very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to Ari Berman, author of Give Us Back the Ballot and a journalist for The Nation. He spoke at the Goodman Community Center in Madison on September 27, 2016. His talk was sponsored by the Center for Media and Democracy and co-sponsored by the Madison Institute, the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin, Common Cause Wisconsin, Wisconsin Book Festival, and One Wisconsin Institute. Yeah.